Hadi bakalım.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction, your weekly source for independent commentary on cultural news and politics, where it's always our mission, regardless of who's here, to give you the knowledge, the tools that you need to cut through media misdirection and resist the mononarrative. And speaking of people missing, we're without our friend David Rand today. He is up in Helena, working on some very important stuff, helping to get Defend the Guard passed in Montana. I understand they're having some success. I believe there's a hearing going on like today or right now as well. So pretty exciting stuff. But I am joined by my friend Kyle Mack. How are you, sir?
Doing good. And we're also missing our CIA asset, Bennett.
That's
He's
right.
He's also not here. So it's just the two of us in the studio today.
It's a pretty lonely room in here, but I think we're going to have some fun with it. And we're glad for you to join us. If you are new to the show, please do subscribe. Whoever you are, wherever you are, please like and follow as well. It really helps us as we try to grow this show and bring you more great content. So Kyle, cue us up with what we're going to start the show with. If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit IntelPatriots.com to learn more. That's IntelPatriots.com. This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at RevvedUpPromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
So we are going to be getting into the Tulsi and RFK confirmations, because that happened.
Yay. And it's huge news.
Huge news. But first, I kind of want to get into, the internet's been abuzz with a lot of Elon derangement syndrome. So I have an image here of what we can expect the future to look like. And what the future is the difference between these two images is about 100 years. This is coming from Reddit, where we have Elon Musk holding his son X over his head. And then we have Mussolini holding his son over his head. And
right.
And it's like, you know who else who also had a kid? That's right, Mussolini did.
So if you ever do this, this is now
dog Mussolini whistling. Pose, yeah.
Dog whistling for fascism yep. is what it is.
Yep. Yep. And then I have another just to kind of like drill that in here. We have Kara Swisher. She was on the news talking about her disdain for Elon Musk. And I thought that this was very enlightening.
One of the things that he has is he loves dank memes and jokes, and he loves to make jokes himself and then laugh at his own jokes. And then all the people who work for him laugh at him, and therefore he thinks he's funny. And he's not funny. He's sometimes funny, I guess. I never thought so. But he likes to do okay. this. He likes to engage in sort of these juvenile little pranks. And when he's not doing that, he likes to insult people. And all kidding aside, we don't mind being called these names. But it's a 53-year-old man does not do this. I mean, or this one does. And so he just like this is what he likes. He likes to slag people. I guess it's part of video game culture or something, but I find it unusual.
It's the war on gamers.
53-year-old men don't do that.
No.
No.
I did see a comment under there that was like, somebody's clearly never met anybody's dad before.
Yeah, exactly. Or like, I don't know, Biden calling all of Trump supporters garbage, mm-hmm. you know, like, come on. You're saying there's no name calling from the other side. Like, let's be serious here.
It's also just, these people are so anti-fun.
Dude, I know.
That's the thing right now, and it's the thing that this has to keep rolling, where the right wing and whatever this new amalgamation of this big tent is, they got to keep having fun. They got to be the cool people that people want to hang out with. They want to, like, when you go on the internet, you see them, you see their culture, you know, spread out. Or you could have the Kara Swishers of the world who's like, he likes dank memes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because there seem to be, as we'll see in this next clip, some varying opinions on how the left should deal with the right. And this one caught me really sideways, as I think it did a lot of people on the internet. Let's check it out.
I've been told I have 30 seconds, so I am going to tell you that we do have to... I don't swear in public very well, but we have to Trump.
Whoa, lady. Easy. Apparently everybody's into that idea.
I thought this was a hate rally.
Please don't tell my children that I just did that.
Look, hate is a powerful emotion. It can swing both ways, you know? I just couldn't believe it when I heard that. It's got to be the worst phrasing I've ever heard. And if Bennett were here, he would for sure cue the, are we not saying phrasing anymore? But, oh my God. So the left, in a varying degrees of insanity and hysteria over what's going on in the world right now, as is exemplified by my DMs on Instagram when I post anything remotely supportive of this current administration, at least from my few liberal friends that are still around.
that is the interesting thing, because right now there's always the question of where is the left going to go right now? And everything is still like... There are the reformers that seem to be having, like, I have a clip for the future that we might get into of Dean Phillips talking about this, who was a guy who ran for president against Biden and then he got shafted in the last election.
Familiar story.
But like, there's just the question of where does the left go? Do they continue down the current trail with Doge purging out USAID and whatnot? Like, a lot of these rent-a-mobs that are going, like, they might not be as functioning as they once were.
Yeah, you know, like, who's going to deliver pallets of bricks to Antifa when they spin up these riots that they're rallying for, right? I mean, you've got members of Congress saying, we'll see you in the streets, Elon. Like, okay. I mean, well, good luck. Who's going to deliver the pallets of bricks?
Who will deliver the bricks? If the government doesn't exist, who would deliver the bricks?
Who would deliver the bricks?
Okay, so we'll get into real news,
fair,
which is a continuation of, you know, what's been going on, the confirmation hearings. Two big ones this week, probably
the biggest.
The biggest.
Yeah, I'd say so.
All of them is we have RFK and Tulsi Gabbard. So we'll start with RFK here. I know this is one you in particular are really ecstatic for this
I'm
one.
I'm super fired up by this. Yeah.
This is a lot of like your wheelhouse of the issues that you really care about. But I have a clip here of him accepting the nomination, and then also a second clip of him kind of talking about, you know, what the goals are. So here we'll start with his acceptance.
For 20 years, I got up every morning on my knees and prayed that God would put me in a position where I can end the childhood and chronic disease epidemic in this country. On August 23rd of last year, God sent me President Trump.
All right.
And he gave me... He's now given me, he's kept every promise that he's made to me. He's kept his word in every account and gone way beyond it. I'm so grateful to you, Mr. President. A lot of people told me that I couldn't trust President Trump. I better get it in writing. And we did a handshake, and everything that he told me he was going to do, he has done.
Right.
And I'm so grateful to him, and I've told you before, I genuinely believe that you are a pivotal historical figure, and you are going to transform this country.
Wow. Really, really dramatic and heartfelt words from RFK there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it also goes to show because, and I think it's Trump made a lot of campaign promises, and it's a little shocking as to in the first month of him being in, how many of those have actually been fulfilled.
Yeah.
And just at the rate, like how fast things are going. And there is the, I do remember that when RFK initially dropped out, is like everybody was telling RFK of being like, he's not going to keep his word, he's a liar, blah blah blah, you should get it in writing. I remember when people were saying that, and just the, no, we shook hands and we got it.
Yeah,
like we're here.
Yeah.
Right.
It's so interesting too, because I've been getting a lot of comments as I share stuff like about some of these confirmations or about some of the actions, you know, like auditing USAID and all that stuff. I'm getting a lot of pushback towards libertarians specifically, like, I hope you guys know what you're doing. Like, you know, the success of this rests on you, as if like the libertarians kind of swung this election, which is so interesting because the libertarians have been so irrelevant for so long that like now the Dems are like, well, you sure didn't play the spoiler for us this time, so you better, you know, be able to back up everything that this administration does because you supported them. And it's like, no, I don't think that that's anybody's job. And this may be a little bit of a tangent, but like, I think that a confirmation like this is an example of why libertarians can trust this administration, at least tentatively, because for the first time in my adult life, the government that's been elected is actually executing on promises made on the campaign trail. When else has that actually been a reality in this country, at least in your life?
No, it's also it's a strange thing, too, where this administration, to me, it's like the first time I've ever felt in my adult life any sort of sense of patriotism.
Yeah.
In a sense, like, you know, my adult life, I've had Obama, Trump's first term, and then Biden. And I never really felt a particular sense of patriotism or like this love of everything of where the country was heading. And there actually feels like, no, it's sort of like RFK said, there's this historical, like Trump is this historical pivotal figure. And it's like, you might like the direction that goes, or you might dislike it. I am much more in favor of the direction that seem to be currently going on, especially when it comes to foreign policy, domestic shifts, intel reform. Everything that we're seeing right now, like these are all the issues that I've always cared about.
Yeah.
And we're seeing all of those taking major shifts away from where we've been, where I've just always been so pessimistic on the country.
Totally. And what's so interesting about RFK's confirmation is like, yes, he's been a black sheep of the Democrats for this entire election season. And even prior to that, I'd say since COVID, when he really took, you know, his stances on that issue. But what's so interesting to me is like, you would think that an issue like childhood chronic disease, which is such a huge problem in this country, would be a unifying topic that everybody could get behind. But for some reason, my Democrat friends and a lot of people I know in like the healthcare industry, who obviously have a certain viewpoint, perhaps working within the Western medical model. And I wouldn't say a lot, but I'd say a couple I've seen are just really upset by this. And I don't understand how you could be upset by a guy who comes in and says, I believe it's my mission from God to cure childhood chronic disease. How does that happen?
Well, it's just they're trained to be upset by it,
I guess.
And that's kind of the thing. Like, this is another facet of this is the Elon derangement syndrome, is everything that Doge is going in and exposing with things like USAID and all these different organizations. But USAID really is the big one, because that is the one where we're watching the psyoping going on. Is like, there's money being filtered to Reuters, there's money being filtered to Politico, there's like
Pfizer.
You start to really Pfizer. Like, but no, I'm particularly focusing on like the media for apparatus, sure. Right? But like, yeah, then also just these major corporations.
Yeah. And Pfizer right? funnels to the media too, because Pfizer sponsors mainstream press. So if USAID's giving money to the pharmaceutical companies, are using that to buy the media also.
Well, it's just, you realize it's this thing where like the conspiracies, you always have in the conspiracy theory apparatus where you kind of have, there's one strain of thought that's just like, there's no way the government's efficient enough to do all this and be able to manage all these narratives and stuff like that. We're just like, what we're seeing and what people are coming to realize now with the USAID stuff is it actually doesn't take that much to do massive social engineering operations.
All you got
to
do is write a check to Reuters.
Because USAID is like $44 billion a year. And like, $44 billion covers a lot of ground. It's like, okay, $3 million to this organization, $5 million to this organization, another three over here. And you can do that both foreign and domestically, and you can cover a lot of places. And the sheer amount of psyoping that you can do from an intelligence perspective, like there's 20,000 employees or whatever it is, right? Like it doesn't actually take that much. And now all of that is being unraveled and exposed in real time. And it's all of that stuff, like all of those people now have an incentive and they hire the correct people that have the correct ideology for where the regime wants to go. And then you poo-poo the RFKs, the Tulsi Gabbards, the Elon Musks. You get involved in domestic elections, as we will get into as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Because that was Thomas Massie and Schellenberger on the House floor. We're talking about this this week too, where like, money was going towards organizations that were fabricating information about like for the Trump impeachment.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, what's so interesting about this is, okay, so if we're able to to peel back the layers here, see where the money's been going, and stop the flow of that money. It'll be amazing to see in 2 years when midterm elections come up how capable or incapable is the blob at actually crafting a narrative that paints this administration in a poor light, or is this administration running on the record of hopefully what is going to be a continuation of keeping their promises, able to bring more people around to the reality and the good of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And obviously a lot of that will be, what are the downstream effects? How are people feeling that these policies, these actions that we've already seen being taken, affecting their lives directly in 2 years? And a lot can change between now and then, but it'll be really interesting without that sort of just veneer of corporate press manipulation. What will be the real outcome for this administration, for the Republicans going into 2 years and maybe even 4 years to the next presidential?
I think we're kind of seeing it like Super Bowl ads, right?
Yeah.
They're now way more, they were more patriotic than I've seen in years.
For sure.
You know, they're not just filled with all like the woke mind virus stuff. Like, the culture is shifting right now.
There
like,
were still a couple.
They can't maintain it. Yeah, there's still a couple. And there's going to be the remnants that happen over for a few years. Yeah. But like that stuff's being purged out of the system.
Yeah.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see, who wakes up, how many people wake up from the woke mind virus mm-hmm. stuff that maybe is keeping them locked in this old worldview mm-hmm. where Trump is Orange Man bad and Elon's the new Mussolini and all this stuff. How many people kind of come around to saying, actually, this isn't that bad. In fact, maybe I've got, you know, more purchasing power or, you know, whatever, less competition from low wage workers from other countries or who knows what.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of going into your the some of the goals of RFK in his new position. Here is one more clip from the man.
I genuinely believe that you are a pivotal historical figure, and you are going to transform this country at a time when we see all of the indicia of democracy now in tatters in our country. But we see the rise of military-industrial complex, the rise of totalitarianism, these attacks on our Constitution, and this breathtaking epidemic that is disabling our people. President Trump has promised to restore the American dream in this country. A healthy person has 1,000 dreams. A sick person only has one. 60% of our population has only one dream, and they get better. President Trump has promised that he's going to restore America's strength. But we can't be a strong nation if we have a weak citizenry. If people are sick, 60% of our people are sick, 77%. As President Trump mentioned, our children cannot qualify for military service. And we need a man on a white horse now. We need somebody who is willing to come in and has the spine and the guts and the strength to challenge orthodoxies, to stand in the way of vested interests, and to break institutions that have turned against our democracy. President Trump has shown again and again that he is that hero.
A lot of glazing.
A lot of glazing.
But I think appropriate. Probably appropriate.
Sure. Well, I mean, yeah. We again, it remains to be seen what actually gets done on this issue. I know that RFK had to make a lot of compromises with one of the senators on the committee to get his vote. I'm blanking on his name right now, but
what was the compromise?
Oh, there was a list of them. And I can look them up for you. We talked about him, I think, on one of the Tuesday shows that you weren't here for, but it'll remain to be seen. Obviously it's politics. You got to say and do what you have to say and do in order to get nominated. And then when you get into the position, obviously, maybe some of those things go out the window a little bit. But RFK's obviously seems like an honorable guy, as far as I can tell. So I'm not sure how much he will kind of keep his word to that particular senator, or, you know, do some things that challenge the status quo he's talking about, of these, you know, vested interests and orthodoxies. And some of it was around that, right? Like not, you know, not outlawing or whatever, like vaccines and things like that. Things that would challenge, you know, the pharma complex, which I think is going to be a lot of what he's going to be doing.
Outlawing vaccines was never going to be on the table.
No,
you know,
no.
Like it's those types of things where a lot of people have, again, we've talked about this, but, you know, Trump has this, people in politics just have this in general, is people have these like fantasy visions of what these people are actually about. And RFK is not this like radical 100% I hate all the vaccines guy. He never has been.
No.
But like, there's questions of like, not every vaccine is the same, you know?
Right. Or as was brought up in his confirmation hearing, you know, not every person should get the same vaccine because people's immune systems are different.
Yes. Like very, very like basic things like that. But everybody will then paint a bright, like Trump gets this too. Everybody has these fantasy visions either in like in a heroic sense or in a villain sense of what Trump is about.
And, right.
And almost everybody, like his most loyal supporters and then his most like hated enemies, they all have like a completely wrong view of who Trump actually is.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. It's either complete like hero worship mm-hmm. or complete vilification.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think people should just remember that, you know, talk is cheap, right? From everybody. And these are all fine words and we love to hear them, but we should judge these people by their actions. And so far, like I said, it seems like the Trump administration is keeping their promises. RFK certainly seems to feel that way. Look forward to seeing RFK keep his promises.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because, you know, at least in this first month, I would have expected more resistance to to all of this stuff than we've actually been seeing. Like, we've been seeing the resistance, but I thought there would have been a stronger effort, like, or not a stronger effort, but like just the resistance would have been stronger.
Yeah,
things. Especially on the Doge side too, like, because like RFK is going to be a very Doge-like figure for
HHS.
For Health and Human Services, where he's going to be going in and cleaning up shop, and he's going to probably be giving Elon full access.
Oh, you
and
can
to
imagine
doing that, right?
Oh yeah.
But like, it seems like the opposition of like the regime is just not competent enough anymore to be able to resist this that I thought they would have.
I totally agree. And it's interesting. It's either concerning that like there's something bigger at play that they're like working on that doesn't necessitate that mm-hmm. they mount this huge resistance right up front, or it just speaks to the efficacy of this sort of like shock and awe campaign that the Trump administration has been on for the last 3 going on 4 weeks of like just this deluge of EOs. And I feel like the establishment is sort of on their heels with this. They haven't been able to respond.
There's also an element of the current opposition in the regime. They're like the inheritors of the people who were really good at functioning these things.
Yeah.
You know, not the same.
They're like
people.
The trust fund kid that like inherits the company and drives it into the ground.
Yeah. It's kind of that, like the people that were really good in propping up the regime in the beginning. These are the kids and the future generations that inherited it. And they don't have the backbone and the strength to be able to, put up the effort.
Yeah. These are the weak men that from the good times, their fathers
the
and
regime,
grandfathers were the hard men. Yeah, totally.
I think that there's an element of that too, where it's just like, they're just not sending their best anymore.
They're just not. And I'm fine with it. I'm here for it.
we'll move on to, Tulsi also got confirmed, for NDI.
Rock on. Bingo square for me.
Yeah, but next week you're going to be losing one because Kash Patel is going to be coming in next
week. That's true. That's true. I'm happy to be wrong on that. Yeah. If that happens, I'm happy to be wrong on it.
So Tulsi came in, and here's just a little bit of this will showcase what she's about. And then we're going to get in a little bit into dig into the details of what some of this means and stuff.
Mr. President, first and foremost, I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for the trust that you have placed in me. To fulfill this critical position as Director of National Intelligence at any time, but specifically during this time. Unfortunately, the American people have very little trust in the intelligence community, largely because they've seen the weaponization and politicization of an entity that is supposed to be purely focused on ensuring our national security. So I look forward to being able to help fulfill that mandate that the American people delivered to you very clearly in this election to refocus our intelligence community by empowering the great patriots who have chosen to serve our country in this way and focus on ensuring the safety, security, and freedom of the American people. As you've said, Mr. President, this is what I've dedicated my life to, and it is truly humbling to be in this position to serve in your administration, help to rebuild that trust, and ultimately to keep the American people safe. Last thing I'll mention, that in your National Prayer Breakfast speech, you made a statement about your legacy of wanting to be remembered as a peacemaker. I know that I can speak for many of my fellow service members who are here today, veterans, Medal of Honor recipients, how deeply that resonates with us. For those who volunteer to put their lives on the line when duty calls, but to have a president and commander in chief who recognizes the cost of that sacrifice and ensuring that war is the last resort, not the first. So thank you for your leadership on behalf of my friends here and all who wear the uniform. We're grateful. Thank you.
Great speech.
Yeah.
Very good speech.
It also, so first off, probably one of the most important things, how was her fit, Joe?
God, I love, let me roll up my fashionista sleeves here and get in on this one.
Well, because it's interesting, just to preface this, is she went all white for the Senate hearing.
That's right.
And then she's going all black here. Is this certainly, is it symbolic?
I would certainly say so. I mean, I don't feel, and we talked a little bit about this before we started recording, but I don't feel like that there is any apparel decision in events as significant as these that is not considered. I think Tulsi, well, I don't exactly know what her strategy would be behind the white for the confirmation hearings. White in color psychology, right? Very innocent, pure, you know, maybe trying to wash the Assad toady label off with that one a little bit. I don't know, but still very professional, right? Looked super sharp. Little overexposed on the C-SPAN feed, but, or the PBS feed, but that's their problem. Fox News had it right. In this case, going to black, I mean, gosh, that is a statement. Like, that you can't go more polar opposite, right? In color, for this sort of thing. So what I'm feeling from this is a funeral for the deep state.
It's she's going into war mode right
she's
now.
Going into war mode. And I gotta say, the like that streak of gray that she has in her hair is just so badass and menacing.
Very like the entire aesthetic is very interesting.
It really is.
Especially because the whole reason for the gray streak is like the stress of war and all that stuff. It's supposed to be, it's supposed to symbolically be that. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that she's embraced that too. Cause that's, I mean, just, I don't know. It's just, it's badass.
Well, so yeah. So she's in as NDI and
DNI
or
Director of National Intelligence.
Yeah. I typed that wrong.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah. DNI.
That's fine. We're all a little.
That's why I was looking at the national. Like I was like national director. Of, no, that's not right. Director of National Intelligence.
Yeah.
Okay. Notable no votes. Mitch McConnell. He's the only buddy. He's the only person that crossed party lines on both RFK and Tulsi.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so he voted no on RFK as well.
Yeah. And he's supposed to be voting no on Cash as well.
What a guy. You know, at least he's consistent. at least he really makes his hatred for this administration known. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know what? I think we would all appreciate me getting one more bingo square with Mitch McConnell leaving Congress this year. That would just be the best thing. Because really, I mean, he's already had one fall this year.
The turtle falls on his back and he just can't move anymore.
Look, I'm not, I take very little pleasure, maybe just a little in his fall from grace, no pun intended. Because I think he's just a terrible person. I'll take a little Tucker Carlson note there. But honestly, I really just think he's like an awful representation of the state of Kentucky, who also gave us Thomas Massie and Rand Paul. And I can't believe that state would give us such
such a
turd when we have those two coming from there as well.
Mitch has been a very strong political operator over his career. Like he's been very good at it. And back when the party was still controlled by the right wing branch of the regime, he was very good at promoting the party's like goals in that manner. But
and in
it's
that
new
way,
leadership, new management, new ideology that
exactly
exists within the party.
And he is just so indicative, especially with this contrast of being this like lone wart of the bygone era of the Republican Party. And I just like really revel in the idea of him no longer representing anybody.
Well, and so he cited issues, particularly on the Tulsi thing. His issues were Snowden.
Fair.
China, Russia, and her views on intel collection methods.
Yeah. Which again, totally par for the course for this guy. He doesn't respect people's Fourth Amendment rights. He doesn't respect the Americans, and he's a total war hawk.
I have seen online a lot of people were putting as like he voted against these guys, which was RFK and Tulsi, and then they put up images of people who he did vote to confirm, which was like Mayor Pete Buttigieg for Department of Transportation. You know, like yeah, it does show
arguably the worst Secretary of Transportation in our nation's history.
That was just the one that came to mind, but there was a bunch of those that came like that.
Yeah. Well, again, just on the wrong side of history, and good riddance to this guy if and when he ever decides to.
He said that Tulsi failed to demonstrate that she is prepared to assume this tremendous national trust.
I couldn't disagree more, but again, I think my position is fairly clear on this issue.
there's another interesting one here, which I find Bernie Sanders, like all Democrats, I guess he's an independent, but all Democrats voted against all of the picks. I think that's like, but yeah, Bernie Sanders and Tulsi have a particular history, which is interesting to see. Like you thought, like if you were a Bernie bro, you might have thought, maybe he would come alongside maybe RFK, but Tulsi in particular. And one of those is because Tulsi's fall from grace from the Democratic Party was initially kind of kickstarted by her stepping down from being vice chair of the DNC in order to support Bernie Sanders in 2016.
When he got screwed over in lieu of Hillary Clinton getting the nomination.
Yep. And this is when all the email scandals came out, like Hillary Clinton emails. You had the Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was the chair of the DNC, kind of rigging thing. We just see it like rigging things for Hillary Clinton. It's when you had all the Donna Brazil handing the debate stuff. It's when Seth Rich died. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is when all that stuff went down. And we actually have a clip here coming from this is Tulsi back in 2016. Resigning in support of Bernie.
As a vice chair of the DNC, I'm required to stay neutral in Democratic primaries, but I cannot remain neutral any longer. The stakes are just too high. That's why today I'm endorsing Senator Bernie Sanders to be our next president and commander-in-chief of the United States. We need a commander-in-chief who has foresight, who exercises good judgment, and who understands the need for a robust foreign policy which defends the safety and security of the American people, and who will not waste precious lives and money on interventionist wars of regime change. Such counterproductive wars undermine our national security and economic prosperity.
And you kind of get the point.
Yeah. I mean, respectfully, I think she was wrong about Bernie, mm-hmm. but she did step down in support of Bernie, and then, of course, Bernie turns around and votes against her confirmation for Director of National Intelligence.
Well, I'll push back on the wrong about Bernie thing, because I think it's hard to, like, people in our milieu to kind of put ourselves in the perspective of the Democrats
sure.
at this time period,
yeah.
where Bernie Sanders was, like, the Ron Paul of the Democrats.
Absolutely.
Right? So, like, and kind of seen as the guy who, among the Democrat, going against the Democratic regime— at the time, and people saw that, but then it kind of comes down to after he was ousted, he kind of just fell in line with everything.
Totally.
And he's been continuously falling in line.
Right.
It's not like Ron Paul didn't then endorse John McCain, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Bernie Sanders did endorse Hillary Clinton.
Right. He took the beating and then dutifully backed the person who administered the beating.
Well, and the political savviness of the time was so interesting too, because we had Elizabeth Warren was positioning herself to be like the female Bernie Sanders, and she became the hitman against Bernie at the time. Basically, her campaign was going out saying Bernie Sanders is sexist, Bernie Sanders is this, that, and she was the one that was like, I'm the Democratic Socialist, I'm the one with the true outsider. Yeah, the person that's like on the banking committee and just falls in line with the banks every single time, right? Like, but she was like, I hate the banks, despite getting all the money from the banks.
Yeah, yeah.
And when
just the same way that Bernie says I hate pharma while getting a bunch of pharma money.
Well, it was one of those things too, where it was like, I think it was like Super Tuesday. I can't remember. It was one of the big time periods during the primaries. Everybody except for Biden dropped out. It was like Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, all of them dropped out except for Elizabeth Warren. And then the votes happened, and she pulled enough votes away from Bernie to be able to do anything significant, and then she dropped out the next day.
Right? Be a little more transparent. But, you know, we know, because of that era, that's exactly how the DNC operates. They have superdelegates. They can basically do whatever they want and select whoever they want. It's not a democratic process, really, within that party. And that's their right as a party to run their stuff however they want to. But what I would say is, Tulsi was proved now to have been wrong about Bernie. Not necessarily. Yes, he was the Ron Paul of that era. And I would say even then I looked at Bernie Sanders, although disagree on many, many issues.
I was kind of supportive of what he was doing in the DNC. Right.
Right, exactly. I looked upon him more favorably then of course I do now, especially because after he fell in line and after he kind of just went along with the party and stopped being, you know, the guy who was sort of the change maker within the establishment. He kind of just became the establishment. And it's like, and I've seen this too, as I've shared some of the stuff with, like with my network, with my Bernie friends, I'm like asking them to help me understand who this guy is, because I thought he was one way and now he's very much not that way. And they're just as confused. So I think he's losing a lot of his kind of tried and true ardent supporters during this process as well.
Yeah. It's one of those things. Well, I think, some of it is the Bernie to Trump pipeline is there. There's a lot of Bernie people that ended up going towards Trump. We saw that in 2016, and I think we've just continued to see that.
Yeah.
So like, there was a lot of people that were on board with the Bernie program, not necessarily because of, like, the socialism side. It's more so of like this FU to the establishment and the Democratic establishment.
And his anti-war sentiments as well, which is referenced.
What Tulsi referenced, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, there were definitely reasons for sort of those left progressives to come across the aisle to this administration, because if you're an issue-based voter, if you're not focused on like sort of the demagoguery of like this person that you idolize, but you focus on what they say and what they plan to do, there's a lot of reasons to cross that divide.
Yeah, it's just like, it's just interesting seeing the broader point of like Bernie bros being kind of in shambles about all this right now, of like,
they've had their hearts broken.
They've had their hearts broken.
On Valentine's Day.
Bernie stocks are down. Yeah. You know,
down bad.
They're down bad. Crashed. Rug pulled.
Rug pulled. Bernie totally rug pulled his early investors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, it's just that dynamic is interesting to me. And we haven't really seen somebody on that side rise to the new mantle of being the anti-establishment Democratic figure. Like, at one point, it was kind of viewed as AOC might take up that mantle and like with the squad backing, but she's kind of conformed now too. And she's kind of playing the game. I think she has a pretty big political future with the game that she's playing.
I think the reason for that though, is that the Democrats kind of are the establishment right now. Like, they are the empire, and there are, you know, establishment Republicans like Mitch McConnell who, you know, show themselves in this process based on who they vote for confirmations. But it's going to be really interesting to see the cognitive dissonance knob turned up to 11 for a lot of leftists who feel in their hearts that they're anti-establishment, when all the layers of deception are pulled away, as we're seeing, to see how much more difficult it gets for people to say, I'm still on the right side of history. I'm still rooting for the good guys. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
That's actually the really interesting psychology, is there's so much, and we've just, in the last couple of years, we've finally seen this break apart, where for decades, the left has held on to this, like, no, we're the people for free speech, because like, we were the free speech people when Bush was cracking down on free speech. Like, no, we're the people that care about civil liberties. No, we're the people that care about, and they've been like holding on to this thing of decades past where like, yeah, the Democrats at one point in time championed these things.
Oh, for sure.
But they haven't in a while.
It's been a long time.
And then you have all these people like still thinking that the Democrats have been like people like Joe Rogan were people like that until recent years.
He was a total Bernie bro.
Yeah. Like he still thought that was like what the left was supposedly about for a long time. But like, you have a lot of these people who are like nominally political. They don't actually pay attention to the nuts and bolts of how the winds shift, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lag before people kind of really understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's like, this election, I think, we saw the full brunt of it, of like, okay, now the populace is kind of, they understand now.
More of them. More or less,
yeah.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how more come around as we get a little bit of space from the ripping of the Band-Aid that it sort of probably feels like to a lot of Democrats right now. How many of them go, okay, maybe this is actually kind of safe to go here? Because again, it's like, it's a tribal thing. Politics is tribal, just like everything else. Humans don't want to be alienated from their tribe. But if they feel like the majority of the tribe is doing this other thing, and they're over here with this kind of small, hopefully more and more fringe group feeling, you know, on the outside of this cultural shift that's happening, hopefully that momentum, that gravity pulls people along with it. Yeah. I think that would be a great thing.
Yeah, and well, and actually, to maybe go into, we'll kind of skip over. Kash Patel is going to be going in the Senate. His confirmation is going to be coming in next week. He made it through committee 12-10, so, and it looks like he should be brought in. It should be the same vote spread. Mitch McConnell not going, but all the other Republicans.
And these have been very close votes. Again, it's like what I think 53-47, something like that. Like pretty close. Pretty close.
They need, if three Republicans dissent, then it's a problem.
Right.
That's kind of where it's at right now. But kind of like continuing on the same train of thought that we've been having about where the Democrats are and maybe the future of this. I saw this interesting clip from, and Elon Musk broadcast it, from Dean Phillips. And if people don't know who Dean Phillips was, he ran for president in the primary in this last election against Biden, and he got completely screwed out of it. Mm-hmm. Right. Like they just.
It was him and Marianne Williamson as well.
They both got hit. And he was running on this, like, the Democrats need to reform kind of message of the Democrats have gone too far. They need to kind of come back to the middle. The establishment has kind of taken over the party. Like, that's been his message. And, and he got, you know, he got some funding from, like, kind of like the tech bigwigs that, like that, who were still kind of nominally Democrat and they want to see a good Democrat party, blah, 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 before they all came into the Trump sphere. Right.
Because and it should be mentioned too, because people might forget, like RFK wanted to run as a Democrat initially also.
Also, yes. Yeah.
And they wouldn't let him.
Yeah.
So he left.
Yeah.
So and look at him now. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, so, and so we have Dean Phillips here talking about kind of the Elon and Trump derangement syndrome and how the Democrats need to steer away from it.
Unfortunately, Democrats are only focused on one thing right now, Mr. Musk. The fact of the matter, he's quite popular. He has the largest platform in human history, which is, of course, Twitter/X. And I think we're missing the boat as Democrats. And all I'm saying is that sometimes it's better to join them and actually play a role in how the strategy works rather than so pathetically, frankly, try to combat something that clearly is a steamroller and Democrats are being steamrolled.
I mean, measured take. You know, if you can't beat them, join them is sort of the essence of that.
I remember he was interviewed by All In at one point. Might have been their election night live stream or something. And he was asked, would you play a role in Doge? And he's like, yeah, if they asked me, I would join. And you have that coming from a Democrat, right?
That's so interesting. I mean, I don't know a lot about Dean Phillips. Is he the kind of guy who would join in good faith, or would he join to try to, like, you know, obstruct progress?
From what I've seen, he really wants to see the Democrat Party reform away from the nonsense that they've been over the last decade. Like, he really wants to see that reform happen. And right now, it does not seem like the Democrats want to reform.
I think there's just too many swamp monsters on the take in the party for that to happen, right? I mean, they haven't seen the sort of this new revolution that's occurred on the right. They're still the establishment.
Well, I mean, just look at, you know, we're talking about Tulsi and RFK, both former Democrats, and
Trump, and former Democrat.
Trump, the sitting president. But we have Dean Phillips is saying, sometimes maybe you want to become a part of it and you want to join it.
Yeah.
Because the boat is going without you right now. And the entire Democratic Party is being left behind with this new wave of where the country is moving right now.
Is this just a really long con to rebrand the Republican Party as the Democratic Party?
It's like old school JFK Democrats. Yeah. Like that's what the Republican Party is becoming. It's like JFK Democrats.
Is it the progressive left, like moving the Democrat Overton window too far left and abandoning people? Or is this just like, hey, we're just going to infiltrate slowly over time and then just totally co-opt the Republicans? All right. Tinfoil hat off. But that's my conspiracy take.
Well, it is interesting too, because like kind of in that same vein of like where the Democratic Party is at, we have Ana Paulina Luna, which this is an interesting kind of, the internet has been a little bit of buzz recently because of this. Ana Paulina Luna, congresswoman out of Florida, she has been appointed to head the Task Force on Declassification of Federal Secrets. So this is where the JFK files are going to be coming out of the MLK files, et cetera. This is kind of what the executive order is signing in for that stuff to happen. And I was a little it was interesting to see how the internet has kind of reacted to it. But actually, before we get into the internet reaction, I have a video from APL here where we can just kind of get the vibe.
The Task Force on the Declassification of Federal Secrets has been organized under the House Oversight Committee and represents a historic step towards transparency and delivering answers to the American people. President Trump has already taken steps to deliver to the American people information that for far too long has been kept under the federal government's lock and key through classification. Under Executive Order 14176, President Trump has directed the federal government to prepare reports regarding the declassification of records regarding the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. The task force will also examine agencies' knowledge and possession of documents regarding other areas of significant public interest, including UAPs, the origins of COVID-19, the Epstein client list, and details surrounding the death of Osama bin Laden in Operation Neptune Spear.
The Neptune Spear thing is a thing that I've always been curious about. Like, I'll pause it there, but you kind of get the vibe of what this committee is supposed to do.
Yeah, and there's a lot of varying opinions on the way that this disclosure project is going. You want to dig into that a little bit?
Yeah, like, I was intrigued. I'm always intrigued of, like, watching where the different factions of, like, internet subculture among politics always are looking. I always pay pretty close attention to that because it always gives me an eye of, like, okay, in a few years, this might grow into be that, like, we're seeing the seeds planted for future factions happening. And I'm seeing certain factions among the right now of having this, they're not happy about the task force. Like, they allegedly want to see all this stuff revealed, but they're unhappy because they thought that we're just going to see a big information dump and it was just going to be, like, open to the public. And, like, did you really think that was going to, like, did anybody really think that was going to happen?
I mean, I don't know. Hard to say.
Like, there's still reasons to have things classified and stuff like
For
that,
sure.
Whether you agree or disagree with classification processes, blah, blah, blah. But it turned into, so there's that kind of, they're annoyed by that aspect of, like, nobody wanted somebody to just, like, an organization to sift through it and then feed it to
the public.
Didn't
want an intermediary that could be construed as curtailing the information that is going to be released to the public. They want everything released to the, the internet sleuths to dig through and release in their internet way.
Yeah, but then the internet, so, like, yeah, there's, like, the concerns about, well, it's not going to be as transparent as we want it or whatever. But then it turned into, like, hit jobs on APL, on Anna Paulina Luna, where, one, it's, like, Jewish ties. So there's that element that
which
are coming in.
Which potentially lead to concerns around her objectivity on this?
Yeah, because we have the very likely Mossad connections with Epstein and also
JFK.
And JFK. There's very likely Mossad connections there. But then it also is like she's actually lying about her name for political reasons because she's actually more Jewish than she lets on than she is, like, Hispanic.
Oh.
Her, like, Luna is not her, like, actual last name. It's like Meyerhofer. And then it turned into, well, back in 2014, apparently she was a dancer at a gentleman's club.
Turns out Luna was her stage name at that point. So she just felt like, you know, she wanted to keep that around.
Yeah, because there was some sort of, like, police report where there was, like, a fight that happened at the gentleman's club or something. And then so it's turned into this, like, it's like this. But it's sort of like it's reminding me a lot of the Vivek situation where we're now watching. There's, like, these antibodies that are happening inside the big tent that are trying to purge out a lot of key figures where it's like they turned on Matt Gaetz, they turned on Vivek, they turned on Anna Paulina Luna. And all the people that they're turning on have been kind of the people with the biggest media profiles throughout the Trump rise too, where, like, they've been, like, the closest Trump allies. And we're watching all of those people get turned on by these certain very specific factions within the ecosystem.
What do you credit that to? Do you think that those forces, those antibodies, as you describe them, are, plants or something like that?
I don't know. Like, there might be some co-opting that's going on with very specific figures. And there might be elements of certain figures, maybe some sort of intel connections. I wouldn't be surprised by that. It's actually kind of funny is, Tucker on, this is a slight aside, but Tucker with Mike Benz, I think, basically laid out my exact theory, which I think I mentioned on the skiff. I don't think I've said it on the public episodes, but where I said that I kind of think that every single British media personality that operates in American politics is actually just MI6. And Tucker like straight up said that with Mike Pence. And he basically called out without saying his name, Piers Morgan.
Oh,
for
yeah.
It.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's always worthwhile keeping that type of stuff in mind where it's like you have these entities coming in and like purposely causing friction and fracturing the movement in such a way where
they're
I'm
still
always
bitter.
Like, be skeptical of that.
The British are still bitter about 1776.
Well, I'm not saying that this is like British in particular that are doing this, but those media personalities, yeah. It's always like, yeah. You know, it's worth.
Well, and I think, yeah, anybody with an attachment or a connection to another nation, as we've said before, like, you can be sort of an asset of an intelligence agency, you know, someone that's used by them for a particular purpose without being an operative of, right, on the inside, per se. So, I mean, maybe there's something to that. I don't know. I mean, Tucker is certainly want to lay out some interesting theories here and there, but there could be something to it.
Yeah, but it's just like, I'm just watching, and it's like very particular media personalities. It's like the Laura Loomers of the world. It's the Nick Fuentes's of the world. It's like those people that have like their very specific cult followings, and they're the, like, they're always the exact same people causing fractures. And they always do it like, well, no, we need to clean out the system so we only have the true loyalists or whatever. But like Fuentes isn't even a true loyalist anymore. He's completely like turned on Trump.
Oh, totally.
Which is interesting in itself because he was such a prominent internet figure for Trump at one point.
He was at Mar-a-Lago all the time.
Yeah. Like it's just when you watch that, I always have in the back of my mind, be careful with when these fractures are going on, like those might be more orchestrated than they are natural.
Right. Who's driving the wedge? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's swinging the hammer on that? That's a good question to ask for sure. Yeah.
Alternatively, other elements of interesting news is watching the profound shift in foreign policy from other administrations.
True. This is by far and away the most anti-war administration in my lifetime.
And we even see RFK, who's at HHS, even mentioned, like, he even mentioned in his speech the anti-war stuff.
Yeah.
And then Tulsi. Tulsi has always been very non-interventionist.
She even said it in her resignation speech from the DNC.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I have a few things on the foreign policy front that I just found interesting. It's like interesting signaling. Like a lot of things, they're not, you know, these things haven't necessarily happened yet. They're not in fruition, but like we can start to see the building blocks going on of where the Trump administration is seeming to want to go on some things. And this one in particular, I found to be just an interesting statement that he made at the Oval Office.
One of the first meetings I want to have is with President Xi of China, President Putin of Russia. And I want to say, let's cut our military budget in half. And we can do that. I think we'll be able to do it.
Wow.
You know, I was like, is that going to happen?
Yeah. If David were here, he'd say, judging by what he does, not by what he says. And I totally agree.
But it's important to know, like, signaling and rhetoric matters for the future of things, right? So he's essentially just proposing a trilateral agreement, a sit down between the three major powers in the world and being like, let's cut everything back. And if he accomplished that,
that's legacy right there.
Wow.
That's legacy.
Wow. Well, it also goes alongside afterwards. He had a phone call with Putin and he tweeted out what his phone call was like.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth reading all this. So he puts out on Truth what it was. I just had a lengthy and highly productive phone call with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. We discussed Ukraine, the Middle East, energy, artificial intelligence, the power of the dollar, and various other subjects. We both reflected on the great history of our nations and the fact that we fought so successfully together in World War II, remembering that Russia lost tens of millions of people and we likewise lost so many. We each talked about the strengths of our respective nations and the great benefit that we will someday have in working together. But first, as we both agreed, we want to put a stop to the millions of deaths taking place in the war with Russia-Ukraine. President Putin even used my very strong campaign motto of common sense. Russian asset. Russian asset.
I love how he's claiming the term common sense as anyway.
But we both believe very strongly in it. We both believe in common sense.
Quite true.
We agreed to work together very closely, including visiting each other's nations. We have also agreed to have our respective teams start negotiations immediately, and we will begin calling President Zelensky of Ukraine to inform him of the conversation, something which I will be doing right now. I have asked Marco Rubio, John Ratcliffe, Director of CIA, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, and the Ambassador and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff to lead the negotiations with, which I feel strongly will be successful. Noteworthy, Steve Witkoff was instrumental in the ceasefire in Gaza.
True.
So he's having him on there. Millions of people have died in a war that would not have happened if I were president, but it did happen, and so it must end. No more lives should be lost. I want to thank President Putin for his time and effort with respect to this call and for this release yesterday of Mark Fogel, a wonderful man that I personally greeted last night at the White House. I believe the effort will lead to a successful collusion, hopefully soon.
Conclusion? Not collusion. Very important distinction right here. Speaking
Sorry,
of
Freudian
Russia.
Slip, Freudian slip.
Very successful Russia collusion. Hoax. No, I mean, great statement. Very, very promising for them to have such a productive phone call, what it sounds like. It also seems like the call with Zelensky did happen, and that seemed to have also been productive. Zelensky put out a statement about it. I'm really optimistic that they will get the Ukraine war ended within the first 100 days. I know betting markets shot up dramatically on the success of that mission as a result of these talks. And obviously, you mentioned earlier that they even discussed visiting each other's countries.
Yeah, he's put it in
there. Which he said in that. And it's like, that's
just
kind
from
of unprecedented.
From a symbolic diplomatic perspective.
Yeah.
Like, that would be...
I can't imagine that.
Well, it's like, remember Kim Jong-un in the first administration.
Yeah.
The whole Trump walking across the DMZ line was crazy. Like, to me, that was one of the most impressive things of the Trump administration, of the first administration, first term, was the Kim Jong-un stuff. And then John Bolton came in here and like ruined everything.
Yeah.
Alongside CNN and the media and all that stuff.
I think Trump going to Russia is probably safer for Trump than Putin coming to the U.S. is for Putin.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if I were Putin, I would be like, this, you know, intelligence apparatus, the deep state that has done, stopped at nothing for the last, I mean, since the Cold War, mm-hmm. to fucking end this country and to kill him as long as he's been president and degrade their military capability. I mean, I would not step foot in the U.S. if I were him.
It would be a profound sign of trust if they did it, like, on the working relationship that could be had. Like, if all went well,
I'm not even sure it's worth it though. Like, they don't need to go that far. Just end the war and just get it done.
Yeah. I don't know.
and reduce the military budget.
I'm reminded of like Nixon going to China and like, you know, like those things do have very big historical significance.
They
when
for sure
that
do.
Happens.
They for sure do. But I think the stakes are higher for Putin right now.
They are very high.
Like, imagine just for a second, Putin comes to the U.S., gets whacked by, you know, some operation. What happens? All of a sudden, Trump's
nukes are off.
Deal partner is gone, and God knows who comes in to replace him, and who knows who he's allied to or what his values are or whatever, like, and what rapport he will have with the Trump administration or whomever else within the deep state. I mean, I think that would be foolish person.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it'd be like high risk, high reward. Like, I think the symbolic victory of that just for peace efforts, because it seems to be, I was talking about this with some friends recently, where it seems to me that Trump's foreign policy ambitions are that, so we stop being kind of the global empire where we're just managing everybody else's business and we focus on our sphere. So we have kind of like the North America and maybe somebody in South America is kind of like our vassal that is kind of the you know, the region leader of mm-hmm. that. And everything that we're seeing with the Gaza stuff of like United States go and take Gaza and then we'll kind of like give it to the Saudis or whatever. It seems like Trump almost wants to promote the Saudis for being kind of the region leader. And then you have like Russian as their own region leader. And then you have region leaders that are all kind of still competitive with each other, but you open up trade and blah, blah, blah. But it's much more of like, instead of one world hegemon, it's just like everybody focuses on the things in their sphere and they're kind of like the manager of the sphere. That seems to be where Trump's foreign policy ambitions, because Trump, to me, he seems to really care about stability. Like the problem with the USAID and all this stuff that we're purging out of the system, it's not necessarily like foreign involvement. It's like foreign destabilization.
Quite true.
That's the problem that Trump has with this, because like when things are destabilized, you can't just like party and have casinos and have fun. You know, like,
you can't build real estate. You can't trade.
Exactly.
And he's a businessman. He's a deal maker. So it makes sense that he would be pro peace, because again, like you said, you can't have a good commerce in a war zone. That just doesn't happen. No, I totally agree with that. And that sentiment seems to also be echoed by statements from Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who sort of intimated in some statements that, you know, we're moving into this multipolar world, which sort of indicates that we're past the unipolar moment, as it's been called, right, by the neocons of eras past, you know, the Bill Kristols and John Boltons of the world. So I think that could be really positive. And I think that, you know, I think David and I talked about this on the last episode. The U.S. can still maintain a lot of influence in the world broadly without being, you know, the border patrol between Russia and Ukraine, or, you know, buying Gaza, which is just the stupidest thing.
But,
I don't know.
But to me, and this is where I'm kind of like, I haven't looked too deeply into the Gaza situation of like what the actual proposals are. But there's a part of me that's almost like, I'm kind of like, I don't think... There's this kind of this element right now where it's like just straight up pulling out everything and just kind of like letting everything sit is probably also not the move. Like, I think a lot of libertarians just like, just pull out everything right away. Just like cut it off right away.
Straight to
it's sort of like Afghanistan. Like, look what happened when everything just kind of pulled out. Right. You kind of got to have like a take steps for everything to work out. And this is also like, this is like the very pro-Israel and the very pro-Palestinian people. I feel like they both have, again, sort of like we were talking with RFK, they have like they don't understand Trump's actual positions with Israel. Where like Trump just kind of wants stability in the region. He doesn't like, the whole like Israel versus Palestine and like, should Bibi get his greater Israel? I don't think Trump cares about that. Right. I think there's almost like, he's like, you know, the Saudis could be a good steward of this region. And then when he says that with Bibi sitting there, Bibi's like, what? Like he doesn't care about kind of the ideological players in the region. He just wants stability there. And he's like looking at the Saudis, we're like, I mean, they got their shit together. Like, why not like just kind of like help them become like the region leaders, and then they'll be our trading partners, you know? He's like looking at it very with a pragmatic point of view rather than the ideology that is poured into Israel Palestine.
Right. And I think that's very true. I was having a conversation last night with a friend of the show who had sort of a similar take on it, where, you know, it's like there's more depth to this Gaza, buying Gaza situation than we currently see, and we have to just wait and see how this unfolds and see what the real deal materializes into. But it could like look like a situation of kind of mutual ownership and like vesting in the stability of that territory, because I mean, I don't know, there's a lot to be dug out from rubble from the last, well, I mean, decades of fighting there, but even just the last couple years. There's a lot of rebuilding to do. There's a lot of resettlement of refugees within Gaza or outside of Gaza. I mean, there's a lot of problems to be resolved, and it's going to take a multi-state coalition to pull that off. I think actually one interesting piece of this is like, by Trump kind of saying the U.S. is going to step in, it almost indicates that he doesn't trust Israel to do it themselves, because obviously they kind of have one goal, and that's just to control the whole fucking thing. Yeah. And kick the Palestinians
out. Very particularly
out.
Like the Bibis of Israel. Like,
yes.
You know,
yes.
The Likud party. Like, because like there are other factions within Israel, and people kind of forget about that. Like, Bibi just doesn't have full blown control over the Israeli government. Like, he's a particular faction.
Well, and prior to October 7th, he was like very much on the outs.
Wild on the outs,
and preparing for some sort of legal action against him, or, you know, was under threat of no longer being the prime minister. Is it prime minister? President?
prime minister.
I forget what they have. In any case, it'll be very interesting to see how the Gaza thing unfolds. But I do like overall the posture of this administration of being much more peace focused than any administration in my lifetime.
Yeah, and it goes to where there's a lot of these things where I think a lot of people just want to eliminate stuff, like the USAID is an example of it. But like, there is arguments for having soft power abroad. It's just kind of like how it works. How efficient is it? Is it actually doing our goals, not just destabilizing every region ever? You know, like those are the conversations that I think as these things start to get cleared out, it's going to take decades for some of these things to clear out. Like the job isn't over with 4 years of Trump, right?
Right.
Like,
no,
that's the hard thing. And it'll be interesting too, because like the more I see J.D. Vance, the more I think he's a future president. You know,
interesting.
And if he continues to move this stuff forward.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of potential there. It was interesting to me that Trump actually was asked this, like, do you see J.D. Vance as a successor? And he said, I don't, but he's doing a really good job.
Oh, I didn't see that.
He said that. Now, obviously, that's like we're less than a month into J.D. Vance being the vice president. So he's got, you know, the better part of 4 years to continue to evolve into maybe somebody who could take over the MAGA movement post-Trump. But very interesting. Should we wrap up with the J.D. Vance clip we've got here?
Yeah. So I think it was just this morning, actually, as I was preparing everything. J.D., he was at the Munich Security Conference. And he had some choice words for Europe as a whole. He talked a lot about their censorship practices, and he also got some German ministers very flustered about it too. But here's just some examples of what J.D. was talking about there.
Recently, and sounded delighted that the Romanian government had just annulled an entire election. He warned that if things don't go to plan, the very same thing could happen in Germany too. Now, these cavalier statements are shocking to American ears. For years, we've been told that everything we fund and support is in the name of our shared democratic values. Everything from our Ukraine policy to digital censorship is billed as a defense of democracy. But when we see European courts canceling elections and senior officials threatening to cancel others, we ought to ask whether we're holding ourselves to an appropriately high standard.
And then I actually have one more too that I want to from the same thing, because the Germans were like really pissed at JD. and so you kind of get that, where he's basically calling out the Euros for
canceling the Romanian election of a democratically elected populist president.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, look at the USAID funding going into Romania too.
Uh-huh.
It's even as crazy as things like the Andrew Tate situation was probably USAID led. Right? Like it gets that crazy in what's going on in Romania, right?
Speaking of Andrew Tate, do we know if Greta Thunberg is USAID funded?
I don't know.
I'd love to see some disclosure on that. That'd be interesting.
I don't know, but like, but actually, for people that don't know the Romania situation, is the United States is trying to build the largest military base ever in Romania,
of anywhere in the world.
Since World War II times.
Jeez,
right? And you know, Romania, right there next to Ukraine, right there, you know, on Russia, right.
That, meaningful that's the, geostrategic positioning.
Yeah. So then you have this guy running for prime minister and Georgescu. I don't remember.
Georgescu, I believe.
Yeah, Georgescu running, where it's just like, we don't want that. We want to be peaceful with both Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah.
That's what he ran on us effectively. And they're like, no. Democracy suspended.
You're picking a side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here's another piece from JD's speech at Munich Security Conference.
And unfortunately, when I look at Europe today, it's sometimes not so clear what happened to some of the Cold War's winners. I look to Brussels, where EU commissars warn citizens that they intend to shut down social media during times of civil unrest the moment they spot what they've judged to be, quote, hateful content. Or to this very country, where police have carried out raids against citizens suspected of posting anti-feminist comments online as part of, quote, combating misogyny on the internet, a day of action. I look to Sweden, where 2 weeks ago the government convicted a Christian activist for participating in Quran burnings that resulted in his friend's murder. And as the judge in his case chillingly noted, Sweden's laws to supposedly protect free expression do not, in fact, grant, and I'm quoting, a free pass to do or say anything without risking offending the group that holds that belief. And perhaps most concerningly, I look to our very dear friends, the United Kingdom, where the backslide away from conscience rights has placed the basic liberties of religious Britons in particular in the crosshairs. A little over 2 years ago, the British government charged Adam Smith Connor, a 51-year-old physiotherapist and an army veteran, with the heinous crime of standing 50 meters from an abortion clinic and silently praying for 3 minutes. Not obstructing anyone, not interacting with anyone, just silently praying on his own. And after British law enforcement spotted him and demanded to know what he was praying for, Adam replied simply, it was on behalf of the unborn son he and his former girlfriend had aborted years before. Now, the officers were not moved. Adam was found guilty of breaking the government's new buffer zones law, which criminalizes silent prayer and other actions that could influence a person's decision within 200 meters of an abortion facility. He was sentenced to pay thousands of pounds in legal costs to the prosecution. Now, I wish I could say that this was a fluke, a one-off crazy example of a badly written law being enacted against a single person. But no, this last October, just a few months ago, the Scottish government began distributing letters to citizens whose houses lay within so-called safe access zones, warning them that even private prayer within their own homes may amount to breaking the law.
So he's just going out there and just calling out the Europeans on all their nonsense right now.
I mean, based as buck, I would say. But well, they deserve it. They're just complete totalitarians. They're completely on the other side of free speech from this administration. And honestly, good on this administration for going and making this statement there.
Yeah, because I saw after his speech, you had the German defense minister, Boris Pistorius, come in, and I'm not going to play the clip because it's in German.
Fair.
I don't know what our German audience is like, but he goes on to say, ripping into Vance, saying, if I understood him correctly, he compares the condition of Europe with the condition that prevails in some authoritarian regimes. Like, that's nonsense. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not acceptable for him to say. This is not acceptable. This is not the Europe where I live.
Like, straight to jail.
Yeah. So he goes in and then he goes into a speech talking about like, well, this is where we need to censor this. And then this is where we need to censor that.
Oh, you know, my God. Like, do you hear yourself? Yeah,
it's like,
I mean, that's to be fair, like Europe doesn't have the same free speech tradition as we do in America. Is it, Kyle, in your opinion, exporting, you know, American values inappropriately for J.D. Vance to lecture Europe on something that we hold dear, but maybe they don't as much?
To me, I think that this is kind of the soft power argument of, I think that this is kind of what the president and the vice president should be doing, is that they should be exporting our values in this diplomatic sense. It's not necessarily in the military, we're going to enforce our values on us.
We're going to bring you democracy.
Like, it's like, hey, if you want to continue trading with us, you want to continue being these allies with us, you have to, and you're going to preach that you believe in this, that, or the other, you should actually believe in this, that, or the other, because you are screwing over our people, you're screwing over your own people. It's making it extremely difficult with things like the Digital Services Act for like our companies to actually be able to operate within Europe. Mm-hmm. Those types of things. I think that is very much within the role of the vice president and the president for them to do these types of diplomatic speech.
Yeah.
These are our values, and we are very concerned with where your values are sliding right now.
Right.
I think it makes total sense.
I think that's perfectly fair. And the hypocrisy of saying we support democracy, we're going to go send a bunch of money to Ukraine to protect their democracy when Zelensky suspended elections there.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to overthrow a democratic leader in Romania. We're going to do all these things, but all in the name of protecting democracy. Like that hypocrisy should, I think, totally be called out, and you're exactly right.
It's exposing the mythology of democracy, of like the mythos that is had where it's like, we're defending democracy. Like that's always, we get bludgeoned into that from when we're young as we are the defenders of democracy. Woodrow Wilson, we're making the world safe for democracy. It's like the sole argument of democracy. And then we're like, Zelensky's not democratically elected. Like this is not preserving, he suspended democracy. We have what's going on in Romania. Like they're not actually like, it's exposing the lies of that we've been living under for so long. And I think that's what I love about what is currently happening in the current timeline that we're in.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I look forward to more of it happening. I think that's a great place to wrap up. So we'll go ahead and put a bow on this one. Thank you so much for watching. We appreciate you. If you have not yet, please hit the like button on YouTube. Follow us, subscribe to the show wherever it is that you're watching. And if you want to get involved in the conversation in greater depth, we are very active on our Discord server. The link is in the description or the show notes below the video. We'd love to see you in there. And one note for members, we will not be doing a SCIF episode today, unfortunately, just due to a lot of different scheduling conflicts, the absence of our friend David, etc. We apologize for that, and we will make sure to make it up to you. But for everybody, thanks so much for watching. It's been Human Reaction. On behalf of Kyle Mack, I'm Joe Sheehan. See you next time.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.